The following is a presentation of the Cold Slither Podcast Network.
Welcome to another assigned episode of the Click Nations Comic Book Chronicles. Yeah, that's right. We have background music.
Love it, love it.
Studio audience.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm your host, Tim D-O-double-G. Woo! And tonight I'm joined by the man behind the sound effects, at Agent_70 on Twitter.
Sup, everybody.
We also have at PCN_dirt on Twitter.
Hello, ladies.
And we have at Roddy Cat on Twitter.
Oh, hang on, I'm putting Iron Man on the mission. No, anyway, what's up?
And we have three special guests with us here tonight. They have a new ongoing series with Boom Studios currently called Joyride. We have the creative team of Jackson Lansing, Colin Kelly, and Marcus Toe.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Yo!
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So, when I first heard about Joyride on, I think it was Twitter, actually, I think the Boom Studios account might have tweeted something about it, and just seeing the cover, which is being displayed right now, which I will put the highlight on it from PCN Dirt, that cover just jumped out at me. I was like, oh, okay, that looks like something that I'm definitely going to be interested in. So it's been my mission to get the guys here on the show, so definitely
That's
looking
awesome.
Forward.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming. And I like that, you know, on the cover here I see it says 1 of 4, but it is currently...
No longer.
That is a dirty lie.
No, we're excited. Issue 2 is the first to not have that of 4 on it, so we're officially unshackled from of 4, and we are on to ongoing status.
That's congratulations. Excellent.
Thank you very much. It's all we wanted out of the book. I mean, we started this thing knowing full well that we wanted to be ongoing, and it was just a matter of, like, look, is that something that's even realistic? It's our first creator-owned thing together. It's at Boom, who ultimately, like, you know, it's not Image. We're not pushing this thing up the hill. Like, they have to be sold on it. They have to make sure that it's good for their business model. So there was a lot of question, I think, early on about whether or not this thing was gonna fly. And fan support has been enormous, and retailer support's been enormous, and you know, people. I mean, just like Tim, you found that book, you supported it, you checked it out. Oh, there it is. Joyride nice. Number 2, No of 4.
Do you guys like how had Jackson worked that in there? We had to see if it would fly.
Oh yeah, like a spaceship does.
We don't get
impressive.
That's the only laugh you're gonna get tonight.
Colin's gonna make you use that badoomch like way too much.
Oh yeah, we're gonna abuse the hell out of it tonight. Yeah, great.
Bad news.
So one thing I was curious for, just when I was doing research to find out about Joyride, I found out that, I guess, originally sort of started from Marcus's brainchild from high school, was it?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, one of the big things that I always tried to do when I was younger and to try to learn comics was to, you know, create. And even if it doesn't go anywhere, the whole idea is to kind of practice your mind into making stories. So I think it started around when I was grade 11, and it kind of went on all the way to college. I ended up drawing 3 issues, but each issue was like 40 pages because I didn't know where to stop with that. And and I put it away for a long time, and then we kind of talked a little bit about bringing ideas from when you were a kid, because that was probably when you had the most true creativity, I think, when you had no one else trying to, you know, tell you what to do at that time. So I brought it up to Stephen Christie, who's a friend of all of ours, who's an editor of mine at one point for Cyborgs User 9, and he was like, you got to talk to Jackson and Colin about this, and that's kind of how we started it all.
Yeah, it was really funny, because we were at a party with Christie, who's, you know, Stephen's been a friend for a long time, and we've known him through Boom, and I've kind of known him socially because we came up in Chicago at the same time. So he's really close friends with a really close friend of mine. So we just happened to be at a party one night around the same time that he's talked to Marcus. And I'm kind of bemoaning the fact that, like, Hacktivist Volume 1 is ending. We had such a great time working with Marcus. And, like, now we're trying to figure out what our, you know, we want to do another comic. Maybe we'll do a creator-owned book. There's Hack. Ah, the old days. And we'll be like, you know, hey, we really want to do something else. We want to, you know, do some kind of creator-owned. And he goes, you should talk to Marcus. We're like, oh, we're like, I mean, do you think he would do that?
Yeah,
like,
we're still
geeking out about Marcus a little bit. We didn't know him.
Yeah, like,
well.
Would Marcus dare to, even, like, Marcus wouldn't want to work with us more. I mean,
Well, Stephen did pay me, you know, so.
That's fair, yeah. That's how I get most of my friends.
I pay them, yes. It's horrible.
But yeah, then, you know, that kind of bug got put in Marcus's ear, and we all kind of started circling each other and trying to figure out if this was going to be something that we could actually do together. And we started talking about things we loved, and it really came down to, you know, space and the fact that we were so jazzed about, you know, Star Trek and all these, like, Cowboy Bebop and all these amazing, you know, space adventures, and how we really wanted to just kind of break free of the server rooms and the suits of Hacktivist, really find something that was just kind of loose and fun and wild. And Marcus was like, well, you know, guys, I kind of got this thing I made in high school. And we're like, oh, you know, like high school art, I'm sure it's like fine. But then we see this stupid thing and we're like, this is not like, oh, the doodles you made in high school. This is primo, like awesome 90s art. A lot of pouches.
But that was the thing. We saw it, and you know, we've told the story a few times now. Like, he told us, hey, I've got this story about these three teens that steal a spaceship, and we were at that very time sitting across from each other, like the two guys in Hacktivist, like the way that those two guys sit across from each other. That's how we work. We're sitting there working at that very time on a spec feature, because, you know, that's where we come from is movies. We were working on a new spec feature that was all about a bunch of people that get together to steal a spaceship. And we were like, well, shoot, okay, I guess we could just, like, drop that idea. We sort of had this really serious conversation, which is like, do we want to drop this spec that we've been working on, you know, which we think could have some traction? Let's just lose it and let's do Joyride, because this has a lot more, this is just going to be a lot more fun. This is going to be the thing that lets us go crazier, lets us go bigger, and the thing that we've, you know, discovered, and one of the reasons we came to comics is that as great as it is working in you know, screenplays, and it is, it's a terrible way to get stuff made, generally. Like, you can get stuff made, and certainly it will happen, and there are some people who get more stuff made than others. We are not those guys so far. We've done a lot of work, but nothing's been shot. And so we were like, all right, well, you know, we could throw another idea on the pyre, or we could do something where the next time somebody's like, hey, what did you write? We could give it to them, you know? Yeah. And so, which has been one of the big boons of comics, is like, if you want to make it, you can do it. And so, yeah, we threw that script in the trash, and I think it to mostly Marcus threw his old idea in the trash, and we all came to this thing brand new and tried to, you know, build something that came from the three of us, like, ground up, and that's Joyride.
So you mentioned, I think her name was Christy, that you met at a party.
Stephen Christy. He's the president of film over at Boom Studios now, but at the time was the editor-in-chief at Archaea, who were the imprint that we were doing Hacktivist with, who got, you know, they merged with Boom, and then Stephen kind of got bumped up.
Yeah, okay. I was kind of curious as how all three of you just came together, even back to, I guess, starting working on Hacktivist.
Kind of interesting because, yeah. I mean, a lot of the realistically, I mean, comics is such a small industry. Once you know one person, then it just kind of Kevin Bacon style, like, everyone knows each other. So that's kind of how Steven was for us. And then through that, Rebecca Taylor, who was our editor for Hacktivist, also, you know, put us all in together. And, you know, through that too, I mean, she moved on to DC, but, you know, she was going to be part of Team Joyride as well at one point.
Okay.
And, cool. And we've all, yeah, I mean, when we did all the development on Joyride, with her, and then when she moved over to DC, we have all since worked with her at DC, on those kind of projects. So it's been a fun, kind of transition between the old kind of way of working with Tay, who is the person who brought us all together. She literally came to my house with Marcus's art and tried to, like, sell me on him. And I was like, you don't need to sell me. Marcus is amazing.
Yeah,
right. For, like, the first time they wanted to do Hack.
You'd be the first one.
That's, I know that's bullshit because I know FJ DeSanto and I know how much he likes you. We were very insistent that whoever we work with on Hacktivist be able to land the acting, and what Marcus mm-hmm. delivered was that, and Tay knew that. Tay knew that, like, he drew people who had real, genuine emotion, and so even if we weren't throwing giant fight scenes and shit at the table, like, he would bring the pathos, which is what we needed, as, frankly, screenwriters, right? Guys who relied on actors in a lot of our work, and this mm-hmm. was our first comics. That turned into a very different story on Joyride, where it was like, well, let's go bonkers with this. Let's have a million aliens. Let's do every action scene we can think of. Let's get abstract with our layouts, etc. And, you know, Marcus is what we've discovered now by working with him on three books is that we couldn't possibly be luckier, and that I don't think there's anything we've ever come up with that Marcus didn't do better than we came up with. So yeah. it's a good collaboration because the two of us just sort of get to sit here and be like, wahoo, like, whatever we can think of. And there's really never a big question of, like, oh, can Marcus deliver? Like, he always delivers.
And he always lands. The great thing we can always rely on him to do is land that emotional impact of the characters, you know? Like, he has this little look. I think it's, like, the first or it's, like, a third panel of page one of Joyride where it's just Daywood, one of our characters, just
page three,
Uma's looking at the stars. Daywood's looking at her, and his face is just, like, it says, I love you. Just in the eyes, and it's awesome, and it's like everything we need.
Hold on, I'm gonna praise you one more time. We're just making Marcus so uncomfortable right now.
Twice.
I love this. Colin and I are pretty good friends with Derek Robertson, you know, the comics artist behind, like, Transmetropolitan and The Boys, and he just started on Harbinger Renegades at Valiant, and he and I, like, share art, you know, on occasion. Like, when he's doing something, he'll send it over to me, or when I'm working on something, I'll be like, hey, Derek, check this out. And I showed him the first few pages of Joyride when we were first doing it, and he goes, I love this, because, like, Derek doesn't compliment other artists all that often. Like, you have to be really good for Derek to be like, ooh, I like it. Oftentimes, more often than not, he'll be like, here's what I would do. Yeah. And so I'm showing it to, which is always a masterclass, by the way. It's awesome. But I was like, I checked this out, and he goes, man, this guy's good. I was like, yeah, it's the same guy's Hacktivist. He was like, no way. It doesn't look like, yeah, no, he's like, totally different thing. He's like, he's really good. And he points to that panel, that exact panel that Colin just pointed out, and he goes, the emotion there, like, you just get it. I don't need to read the dialogue. I know exactly what's up with these characters. Like, he's super in love with her, and she doesn't even, like, think about that. And I was like, yeah, exactly. Marcus really delivers. And there's a long pause, and then Derek goes, but if I did it, he'd look a lot uglier.
I know all the news to be known about unrequited love.
Sorry. Exactly.
Perfect.
Why do you think we write this stuff?
We write what we know, right?
That's right. True. We write what we know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were all teenagers with really...
We were all teenagers at one point, yes.
Yeah, with really open hearts.
Right, so real quick, was the transition from screenwriting to comics an easy one, hard one? How was it?
Well, okay. I mean, Colin can probably speak to it a little fresher than I can. I've been doing comics about as long as I've been doing screenwriting. I just was doing it on a really indie level, like nothing big. So yeah. I've been doing it a while.
Sure, yeah. But for me, it was a really interesting transition because the thing, you know, you think, I mean, here's the thing about screenwriters. They think they're the best. They think they're doing the hardest thing. They think they're the greatest. And so you assume, as a screenwriter, like, anything else, easy, not a big deal. Which was, you know, I had kind of that arrogant attitude walking into it. And you sit down and you start to realize, like, the comics page is so, you have to do so much more work to make a comics page sing. It's easy to do bad comics, but to do good comics takes so much effort and so much intuition. And it's not just about writing the dialogue and letting the actors portray it on the screen. It's about layering in everything into that panel and capturing a moment that might be six or seven beats within that single frame. And being able to land each of those in a way that's contextual and emotional was actually pretty fucking hard. And, you know, Jack was kind enough to kind of hold my hand a little bit and walk me through those first steps. And then I think the great thing here is then we do that thing we do where we keep starting to push each other, right? And we really try to start exploring and finding the ways to really innovate and do some new interesting stuff. But now when people ask me that question, you know, young folks like, I want to get into comics. It's like, great. Forget everything you know. and reapproach it as something new. It's not poetry, it's not screenwriting, it's not prose, it's something new and unique, and it's almost like, you know, it's more like being a painter in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Writer.
I often compare the process of writing a screenplay to, or sorry, of writing a comic to, like, boarding a screenplay as you write it. Like, that you're directing the project as much as you are writing the project, which is a really rare, it's in fact generally discouraged in a screenplay. A screenplay is, for all intents and purposes, an inspiration document, right? It's designed to make the director and the producers and the actors who are going to read it, see the movie that's in the writer's head, less so actually beat for beat telling you that movie, right? Because by the time that screenplay gets to screen, it won't be your movie, but it'll be the director's movie, and you have to really, like, inspire what that movie's going to be. That is not the case with comics. With comics, there's an authorial voice that you get as a writer. You're coming in, and this is your thing. You're, like, in the case of Hacktivist, say, we're calling every panel. We're saying what we think needs to happen in each panel. We're talking about the emotion there, and we're relying then on the artist, right, who is ultimately the hero of this whole project, because they're the one who's actually stepping up and doing the job of 50 other crew members, right? If you're the director, then the artist is, like, the entire crew.
I think about it in a lot of ways when I first started drawing comics in the first place, is that you kind of got to think about it like you're writing, directing, and acting in a silent movie. So you have to show more, you have to kind of do more, and you kind of have to wear a lot of hats. So to do all this kind of stuff, you kind of have to understand the breakdown a little bit more than like what Jackson and Colin might say about an inspirational document. You kind of have to know mm-hmm. how someone would act, or you kind of have to be the actor, you have to be the director, and you have to be the writer as well. So
it's very true. And so it's been a fun transition, if only because now when we go back to screenplays, we have to like turn off that part of our brain that's like, ooh, we're calling every panel and we're saying everything that happens and we're getting really specific about how this thing's going to get shot. It's like, no, man, like that's going to ruin everything. Don't do that. Go back, pull out, get inspirational. And then when we come and look frankly at the screenplay form that we've developed as a team. And then when we go back to comics, it's become kind of like it's this adventurous, like every script we start now, we try to figure out where, from a format perspective, it's going to be fun, where we're going to be able to do something that we couldn't do in film. We're doing some stuff right now especially in Joyride. I mean, there's some stuff in issue 3 of Joyride that's just like you couldn't do it, like try shooting it, it wouldn't happen. So figuring out how to do that has been really fun.
But, like, the cool thing is all of the stuff that we're talking about is stuff we really kind of lensed in on with Hacktivist. So that when we started with Joyride, we were able to basically throw all of that out. Because we realized with Marcus, we had this, like, not, he's not, he, like, Marcus is...
A prima donna?
No!
Just a total...
I really tried to make it so, we had a discussion about what we wanted to do with it and how we wanted to write it, and I just kind of wanted to exercise a little bit of my plotting chops or my storytelling plans a little bit more with this book. So, you know, Colin and Jackson graciously allowed me to kind of do my thing, I guess, if you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, basically the if you look at the scripts for Hacktivist, any script for Hacktivist has very specific paneling per page, right? So and sometimes we'd give Marcus shit that was like, sorry, dude, like there's a 32 panel spread in issue 2 or issue 5 of volume 2. There's like a 32 panel double page spread that's just
some of our pages literally start with, so sorry, Marcus, XOXO, don't kill us.
but then on Joyride, we don't panel at all. I think I just paneled my first pages on a script that we just turned in because I wasn't sure if what I was suggesting to Marcus was even possible. So I was like, I want to make sure that we're like, good, I'm going to give you a sample paneling of like how I might do this, and then you figure it out. But like, Joyride reads like a screenplay, kind of. Again, it reads like a comic book, but it reads without panels, and it reads kind of like a screenplay. Like, it's this very... Joyride's a different beast. It's sort of like a jam band with the three of us kind of figuring our stuff out. So we'll write a script. That'll have all of its dialogue, and that'll be paginated. That'll go to Marcus. Marcus will deliver layouts. We'll look at layouts. We'll give what few thoughts we might have on those layouts, and then he'll go straight to pencils and inks. We rarely have anything to say about those except, oh my god, these are amazing. And then when we get our first letter pass, that's the first time. Or we'll then actually go back, based on his inks, do a lettering draft, turn that into Jim Campbell, who's our amazing letterer. He'll do a pass, and then generally we will take that pass and rewrite like 90% of the script based on what Jim just did. Because you can look, you can finally read the book, and you're like, all right, well, from the initial document to the thing that actually came through all of us wanting to do this together, you know, there's maybe some intentions to this scene or this shot or this line that are just straight up different. And that doesn't make them worse or better necessarily, though generally they are better. Just makes them different, and we gotta like address that. So we do a lot of rewriting on Joyride.
Not the fastest way to make a comic book, but definitely one of the most creatively rewarding endeavors like we've ever been involved in, hands down. And I think you guys can be the judge of this, but I think the quality shows.
Yeah,
a lot of love.
Definitely. Yeah. It definitely seems like you guys are having a lot of fun doing this because it definitely shines through every page.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
One of the big things we wanted to add like right away at the beginning, like one of the big themes was that we wanted this to be an accessible comic book, something that people can enjoy and not worry too much that it's going to be too heavy or too heady. You know?
So it gets a little heady. A little bit later. It's fun because we're like, after really kicking in the door on issue one and having so much fun with it, and issue two is similar, where we start to, I think, get to hint at some of the levels to these characters, because these characters aren't all smiles, and when we finally get to kind of see that in issue two, that's exciting. But by the time we get to issue three and four, and they're sort of hitting the end of our first arc, you're really going to see the serious take control of Joyride a little bit, and see how these characters act when stakes are a little bit more dire. And that's been really fun. And then, of course, following up that arc now that we have ongoing is fun, because it means that then we get to kind of change gears again and look at, all right, well, now we've been through some darkness, but what's on the other side of that? Mm-hmm. It's going to be really fun. We're just getting into that side of the project now, and it's been a really exciting move so far.
Yeah.
So it started out as a four issue beneath, and now it's ongoing. Did you write out the mini, or did you have it like a bigger story already planned just in case it was going to go ongoing?
So the fun thing about Joyride is that, you know, we knew what those first four issues were going to be. You know, we had a good idea, and the first four do tell a complete story. You know, we're not leaving it hanging. We're telling a full soup to nuts bit. But we also don't really want to tell, like, this Joyride is not the story of, you know, some, you know, overthrowing a grand dictator or, like, the Grand Rebellion. It's like, it's not about that, guys. Like, you know, it's about being young and cutting out of town for the first time and exploring what it means to grow up, you know, for the good and the bad. So we have an idea of where fun things might be and places we might go, but, you know, who knows where Joyride might end up. I think that's kind of the fun.
Yeah, it's actually something that we do on this book, less so than, like, building out the giant arcs of Hacktivist, is looking at individual issues and saying, what does each issue have to say? So if issue one is the escape, right, it's get to the other side of the moon, steal that spaceship, and run. Issue two is, all right, where do we go first? What's the first encounter? What's it like to encounter aliens and not know what the hell is going on? And as you're seeing on the screen right now, by page 2, 3, and 4, which is what you've just seen, they are already on the run from the cops, right? They hit an alien space mall, and by page 2, Uma has already blown them up. it is not a, you know... Then the book is going to take you on that ride of, like, okay, Uma's going to run. Daywood and Catrin are going to discover a little bit of something about space and about what the world is like out here, and how different it is and how similar it is to where they came from. You know, issue three is going to take you to a very, very different place. Issue three takes place in one new spot, totally different than what you've seen in two, with a very specific encounter that I don't want to get too deep into, but which has really lasting ramifications for our characters. And then by issue four, you're going to see a threat that we start to build on the first page of issue two really pay off and bring some of Earth sort of blazing back into the book. Looking there, that's four issues. We're not really being like, oh, this is like one big arc story. And it is, if you want to read it that way, and the character arcs are there. But we really think about making each issue come alive. So then as we looked to doing 5 through 8, we had some vague ideas of where we want this to go. You know, very like long-term plan stuff, where we're like, we really want to make sure that this character ends up in this kind of place, and this kind of character learns this kind of lesson. But in terms of like the grand epic that is Joyride. Like, it's not Babylon 5. That's not what we're doing. And like, I love that stuff. I grew up on that. It means a lot to me. But I don't think that Gene Roddenberry knew where Star Trek was going. No. I think he was just trying to put really good episodes of television out, and that over the course of that, you found deeper and deeper levels to Kirk and Spock and Bones. Right. And that's what we're going to be doing here. We're coming up with new stories that give us new insights to Kirk and Spock and Bones. Though, now that we've had a chance to break 8, we are definitely introducing some very large-scale plot stuff that is going to have larger ramifications on the book going forward. I think we were very scared to come up with that stuff before we knew it was ongoing, because it would have broken our hearts not to be able to do it. And now we know we get to do it, so it's like, fuck it, let's just run, let's go. So we have, by issue 8, we're going to be introducing we're gonna give you at least to some degree the answer to why did Earth build the Safe Sky? Why did we never leave the planet? What's out there that's so scary?
Thanks for getting into that. I was just going to kind of interject and say if you could and ask you to kind of set the stage for us, because you know, we kind of hit the ground running in this book, but if you could just clue us into, you know, sort of what the setup is.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, the world of Joyride is in a lot of ways our world. It is a place. It's in the future. It's got a world government. It's all that. But it is a place run by fear, and it's a place where people allow their fear to control them in ways that maybe don't end up so great for people. So in this world, in the world of Joyride, what that means is that at some point, a couple hundred years ago, close to our time right now, we went to space. We you know, broke interstellar travel. We got a warp drive going on. We went to space. And what we found out there was terrifying. And we came back. We said, oh my God, it's terrifying out there. And the government, rather than saying, okay, let's go back out, let's understand it more, let's see if it's all terrifying, they took that one mission, they took that one testimony, and they used it to create a massive social change in the world. Basically, once you say everything out there is scary, all of a sudden there's nowhere to go but here, right? So if the very prospect of space travel is taken off the table, and I'd say like right now it's not like we all are like constantly thinking like, oh, we're going to space, but the prospect of space travel is
scared.
Still...
We're constantly scared, it seems, these days. So exactly. I think it's very apt to now.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to say it's very much building a wall.
We came up with Joyride 2 years ago, well before Donald Trump proposed his giant wall on the Mexican border. That's a joke.
Our political system.
I'm really hoping it is.
Our political system is a joke right now.
But well before he had proposed that, we came up with the idea of the Safe Sky, like this big wall around the planet that makes sure that no one can get in. Basically, we were just like, what if you put yourself inside a dice sphere?
What is the most dick move that a government leader can do?
Yeah.
It's like, build a giant wall to keep all the cool stuff out.
Yeah. And so we were like, all right, well, you know, that's definitely what they did, and everybody's really rallied behind the idea that that was a really, really great idea. In the world of, you know, in the world that we are in now, we now actually have people who are proposing that kind of thing, and it's kind of bonkers to us, because we were like, oh, shoot, our book is a lot more relevant than we thought. Like, we weren't trying to be socially conscious in that way. Like, we were trying to be more, like, macro conscious. It sucks how we don't go to space anymore, right? That was really more the move when we first started talking about this. But it's definitely become, I think, a much more, like, hot-button issue, and as a result, we know that we can lean into that because people do understand it. They understand the wall. So that's where the Safe Sky comes from, and everything else, the Allied Youth, conscription service for young people. You'll see every young person that we meet in the first issue is in the military except for Uma. The gun on the moon, which you're displaying right now.
Sure.
The general, like, social homogeny, religious homogeny, all that stuff on this planet, that's all been essentially done because of the Safe Sky, right? The Safe Sky has put us all in a thing. It's put us all in a jar. And unless we can all learn to work together, which in this particular case manifests as something close to a, like, socialist despotism, like, and, you know, there's no going back. Like, there's nothing we can do other than be that. So everybody just kind of fell in line. When you have an individualist like Uma, it makes for a really great protagonist against that.
Mm-hmm. And, like, the fun thing here is that when you put everyone in that ball, the ball becomes everything that there is. So if that's everything that there is, then that has to be good, right? So it's not like these people are toiling away and every day they're like, oh, one day someone will save us. It's like they don't There's no saving you. Like, for them, they think this is a utopia. They think this is as good as it gets, which creates this really interesting petri dish. And, you know, our point here is, like, we are never going back to Earth. Like, this, we didn't fucking want to come back to Earth. Earth fucking sucks. We're going to space. But that petri dish is where all of our characters come from. So, you know, their personal hang-ups, the things they grew up with, the damage they've internalized, that all comes from this social microcosm that's a lot more like our current political climate than we ever realized. So that's why it's important for us to do all this thinking and ruminating, but like, we hope people aren't like, oh wow, that sounds cool, I really want to go back to that Earth, because like, nah, we ain't.
Though I think, as Colin points out, one of the things that's kind of cool about this is that the characters carry around that damage, and as you'll discover on the first page of issue 2, Earth is not done with them. They may be done with Earth, right? But Earth is not done with them. And so that's something that we're very interested in playing with as we go forward, the idea that it is not as simple as running away. The place may try to get you back. Yeah. So, you know, dealing with that has been really fun, and I think dealing with the culture of Earth has been really fun, but as Colin rightly points out, it's the damage that it did to the characters and the amount to which those damages are going to stay with them that makes it relevant. And so to whatever degree we go back to Earth and understand it better and get into the nitty-gritty of why and how and wherefore, it is mostly to help the characters and not so much to build the world, if that makes sense.
Sure, absolutely.
Most people are just interested in what's out there.
Though I'll say this on the fun side of things, whenever Jackson, Colin, and I sit around to like come up with these ideas, a couple times we do it at a bar, and probably the stuff that people overhear us talking about, like,
how many legs are on this alien?
Yeah, exactly. So we came up with this idea about these giant. Well, I mean, I guess I can't spoil it.
Spoilers!
We have this spoiler film. But yeah, like, basically it had to do with some kind of mating season that they bump into of these aliens.
Some really primo alien smut.
So it's pretty good. I mean, and the table next to us was like just maybe within arm's reach. They heard everything.
Oh yeah.
they got all the Joyride info.
But that's so the best thing about Joyride, is to come up with some of these crazy things.
Exactly. Nice. That's why you'll see sort of less and less of the like direct world building and more like indirect. You'll get a lot of backstory in terms of like certain proper nouns about Earth and like who's in charge and shit like that. Like, that'll all happen in issue 3, but not by going back to Earth. It'll happen naturally through the characters.
Okay.
Marcus, how much design or research did you have to do just to create the Safe Sky?
Well, funny enough, that was one of the things we did keep from the original thing that I came out with in high school. I could try to share it one of these days, but I made all these weird designs from when I was in high school. I was really inspired by Joe Madureira's run on Uncanny X-Men, and there was like all that's, even though the Joe Mad's not particularly great at this, he drew this run when Rogue and Gambit are in space and they had to fight the Phalanx.
I remember
sure.
that.
Sure.
Yeah. So
I got those comics.
Yeah. So that was the time when I kind of came up with it. I mean, I updated it obviously, but I mean, for the most part, a lot of these things I just try to think of all the fun things that I liked as a kid and just try not to get too serious with it. Like, if it doesn't make sense, sometimes it doesn't have to, you know?
Yeah.
That's a great attitude. Like, that kind of imbues a lot of what we do with Joyrides. Like, if it doesn't make sense, just maybe don't worry too much about it, because, like, sometimes logic is not particularly fun, so, like, fuck it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the beauty of, you know, we sort of top-line pitch this book often as, you know, it's leaving your town when you were a kid for the first time, right? It's stealing your parents' car when you're 15 and you don't have a driver's license and you're just trying to get away for a little bit and seeing what's in the town next over. And ultimately, you don't understand the rules. So if you're not going the speed limit, you may not know that. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know what the rules in the town over are. You don't know how those people work. You don't know who runs that bar. You don't know who runs the local crime. Like, you don't know. So whenever we walk into one of these scenarios, we get to make those rules up.
Yeah.
There is no world where we're going to be setting up a world and then being like, all right, we got to play by the rules of this world for 5 issues. Like, yeah. That's not how Joyride works. By the time that we have given you an understanding of how that place works, and what Uma has done and how she's affected it, or how it's made Katrin feel, or what David has gone through there, we're going to move on. Same, again, looking at original series Star Trek is, I think, a very good barometer for what you can expect from Joyride in terms of how we're actually going to structure and how we intend for this thing to work.
Oh, okay. I actually see this as kind of like a reverse Star Trek. Like, what would have happened if the Vulcans had been, you know, the big scary bad, you know, the bad guys?
Yeah, that's a great
and
way.
And kind of drove Earth the other way as opposed to...
Absolutely. Yes. Completely.
Yes, that's great. Yeah.
Like, what happens when we don't have the Federation mentality kind of, like, taught to us by the Vulcans, but instead operate from a place of pretty human fear?
Yeah, what if first contact was contact with Jem...
What?
Say again?
Broke up there.
Oh, what if first contact was with the Jem'Hadar?
Oh!
Oh.
We're really pulling out a nerd card.
Deep cut Star Trek reference, I appreciate that.
Yes, nice. That was a deep cut.
Yes.
We live on deep cut Star Trek references over here.
That's
it's
awesome.
Like, it's like,
that's
our,
what's
it's
up.
Like our favorite thing.
That's great.
I just wanted to touch on something that Jackson mentioned earlier. I kind of thought of something funny. Have any of you ever borrowed, quote unquote, a friend or family member's car, motorcycle, or anything to actually joyride?
Well, I had a friend that was always that person, and he'd always steal his. He's like, yo, I'll come pick you up. I'm like, pick me up. And he rolls in front of my house with his parents' car, and obviously he doesn't have the ability, he doesn't have his license, but he knows how to drive. So I remember this one time he picked me up. All we did was to go to the 7-Eleven to get some Slurpees or something like that, and then he... We get back into the car, but he couldn't start the car, and he's freaking out because he's like, "I'm gonna get in so much trouble." We couldn't start the car, and this is the epitome of Joyride. All he did was he forgot to put the car in park when he parked it, so the car was drying, so he couldn't start the car. And then, like, we found out like 10 minutes later that that's what he did, and then like stuff like that, you know. That's what I grew up with.
Is that car you're pushing right now? Is that the Corvette, the Joyride from Star Trek?
Did you
get
in your car back
there? Nice.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well done.
I think it was a full focus. Whatever.
We just need sabotage in the background now.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Listen, all y'all, it's sabotage.
That's right.
The thing about I've never stolen anybody's car. I've never ridden a motorcycle. I'm actually really risk averse as like a person. Or my instincts are, so especially as a kid, I was pretty in line. What I did used to do was steal out to go to, like, music shows. I used to go to punk shows, and I used to, like, I had a fake ID. I'd sneak into a lot of clubs. I've always been into music, so for me it was always a matter of, like, getting into the places to see the weird, obscure bands that I, like, wouldn't otherwise be able to see. And that led me into a lot of mosh pits, which were, like, a big thing for me growing up. I really, like, I found myself in mosh pits. I really enjoyed that. And I used to get the shit kicked out of me because I'm not a very big guy. But those places are really welcoming. So it's actually kind of a really great experience when you're a loner kid and you're just trying to, like, deal with rage issues and stuff. Like, it's pretty amazing. And so I went through a lot of that, and that's, I think, where a lot of that personal experience gets informed into Joyride. But as Marcus was telling that story, it struck me that when I finished high school, I took about 6 months off before I went to college, and I was just hanging out in Virginia where my parents were living, and I had a really, hey, mosh pits, and I had a really good friend named Derek, Derek Every, who's actually a punk and, like, pop musician now. But at the time, we were working at a Starbucks together, and we'd spend all day at work, and it would be totally gross, and we totally hated it. And every day, we would get, or almost every day, I think, we would get together, and we would get in his car or my car, my parents' car, not my car, so mostly his car, and we would drive through the darkness of Virginia, and we would find, there was like an IHOP, it was like the only thing that was open, and it was like two towns over. And we used to just drive through the darkness to get to this IHOP and drive back. And it would take us all freaking night to do it. And, like, you know, we'd bring other people with us and whatever. And we would just have this, like, Nighthawk life for 6 months. Just was like, it wasn't like, wahoo, like crazy. It was just, we're going to the IHOP every night. But it was my, like, escape from my life. Like, every time I needed to get away, every time I needed to go anywhere, I went there. And genuinely, I think that that's, whether it's IHOP or it's mosh pits or it's stealing a car or it's running away from your house or it's, you know, chess club, like, whatever it is that you that gets you out of your normal day-to-day and allows you to find something new about yourself and encounter new perspectives and new people, like, that's what Joyride is. It's not specifically a literal rule-breaking joyride. It's just what happens when you get out of your own skin a little bit and start to understand that other people have something to offer you beyond your sort of own perspective.
That being said, I was a total klepto who would steal pretty much anything that was wasn't nailed down. So, you know.
Yeah. Colin wins the question.
That was my very small rebellion.
I always did stuff. I always just end up doing stuff that no one found out about, which is always my
good.
I was about to
say,
feel but I did the really harmless stuff, though. I mean, like, I used to work at a supermarket, and we used to have, like, races in the back with those hand cart things that you lift pallets with.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
did that,
of course.
Kind of that kind of nice. Thing. Or rollerblading through the schools and stuff like that. For no other reason than it's just like, why don't we just do this? So, I don't
that's,
know.
And that's like great. Why don't we just do this? That is also, that might as well be the caption for it. Like, fuck it, why not?
Mm-hmm. Fuck it, why not?
Yeah, all right.
Are we allowed to swear on this?
Yeah!
We're good.
Probably should have checked ahead of time.
You're good.
All good.
All right, do we have any other questions for the fellas?
Actually, a couple of quick ones. One, since brought up Star Trek, what's your favorite Star Trek? And are you excited for the new one?
I'm a Star Trek Deep Space Nine nerd.
Nice.
I think I learned most of what I know about storytelling from Deep Space Nine. I'm a Cisco kid. I love that show. And I am crazy psyched about the new Star Trek because mm-hmm. Brian Fuller is the absolute bomb. And if these rumors about it being an anthology series are true, I am about to get the show of my dreams. I cannot freaking wait. Cannot wait, you guys.
I personally am a Star Trek Voyager fan. I know everyone looks at me like, hey man, Janeway man, it's all about right, Janeway.
Not Janeway. Right, it's
about
the moment.
It's about like seven of nine, man.
Yeah, well, there's that too, but. What I really like, well, besides also that, you know, you had Harry Kim, an Asian.
Oh, yes! Totally.
That meant a lot. Especially when it came out, I was about, I think, 17. And so to have representation of someone that, you know, looks like you on TV was really important for me. But I'm really excited about the TV show, too, or the new Star Trek. And it apparently is filmed in Toronto, so I'm going
right.
to see if I can try to get an extras spot.
Man.
That would be awesome, right?
If you do that, you got to let me know. I'm going to
come for sure.
And I'm going to join you. That's amazing.
Nice.
Yep. TNG. All the way.
Yeah.
I like low stakes. You know, I just want a bunch of cool dudes, like cool people hanging out on a spaceship doing some chill stick. Maybe Deanna's mom is going to have sex with Riker. You don't know. those really dangerous questions. I like my space safe and antiseptic.
I think I'd be like really missing a chance for self-promotion, and I apologize, but I have to say it. I put out a I don't know if you guys are familiar with Hamilton, the Broadway musical, but I did a parody of one of the songs from that, or like a homage to one of the songs from that, where I changed all the lyrics to be about the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. It's called My Spock. You can look it up on YouTube.
Got several hundred thousand clicks.
Entertainment Weekly picked it up. Like a whole bunch of people picked it up that week. So I was like 100,000 views in a week. I've never put anything out on YouTube. I probably never will again. But nice little bit of like weird Star Trek apocrypha for your fans or anybody who's watching this. Hey, there it is. There's me.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Lest you think that we are fake Trek nerds. those are Jackson's bona fides.
Yeah. Yeah. As my pretty embarrassing Star Trek white guy rap. I'm pretty proud of it.
Hey, I don't know. I've heard you karaoke. It's pretty good.
So that was actually when a couple months ago, March 1st.
Yeah. I literally just had an idea and I recorded it with a few of my friends who were like have a recording studio down the street, and I thought maybe like six people would see it, and then Devin Faraci picked it up on Birth Movies Death, but didn't say anything mean about it, which blew my mind. He just like wrote a really nice article and put it out there, and all of a sudden everybody's like, holy shit, Devin Faraci didn't say something mean, and they all picked it up. So like for a day, like 3 or 4 days, it was just like every site I read was talking, had like an article like this. And then JJ saw it and sent it to Lin-Manuel Miranda, who tweeted it out, and I died. That was the end. That was the end of me.
My last question.
Jackson's been dead the whole time.
I think my last question is, who came up with the for bot? Who came up with displaying symbols instead of words for the robot?
I don't know. That's
a group think, man. Like that's the fun thing. Like we came to that. We were wrestling with the idea of like, you know, we didn't want all aliens to speak English. Like that's so, it's human centric. It's stupid. It's ignorant, and it's also like boring. Like part of this is, how does communication work, right? Like, let's explore it. Let's get weird. That's why you're going to find very few aliens that look human. Because, like, why the fuck would they look human? You know, right. They look like all sorts of crazy stuff. So we were just like, well, how would a bot, you know, how would this robot, screw that. I know exactly how it came through.
Oh, yeah?
We were trying to figure out how Uma was communicating with this thing.
Is
it talking to her on the phone or, like, through music? And we're like, shit, what if this thing was, like, texting with her? Like, texting, right, okay. Like, emojis and shit. And we're like, well, what the, why would it do that? And it's like, oh, boop, 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 maybe that's how it speaks.
And
we're not there now.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, and that was the weird thing, was we were like, all right, well, that's a cool challenge, but again, it's funny, it's the kind of thing that we would normally do to Marcus, where we were like, hey, this is an impossible thing, figure it out. And we'd be like, every bot line reads like, red on black, angry, disagreement, right? Like, that's how a bot line might read.
But yeah, that's the fun thing about the book that we decided to do, because we kind of wanted it to be a little bit more, I don't want to say ridiculous, but kind of ridiculous,
yeah.
is that you can have, like, the robot or anybody, like Colstack or something like that, they can act overtly, like, you know, eccentric or exaggerated, because it's a little bit more cartoony, and then we can do that, so...
Colstack, by the way, is that dude you're seeing right now on your screen in the blue, like, sort of pop collar deal, the alien gentleman.
Right, you haven't character, met we, him haven't, yet, right, we haven't been introduced.
But you will meet Colstack the Wanderer in issue 2 of Joyride. So coming Wednesday, you'll meet the newest member of the crew and the only alien on the crew. We like to compare him to, like, he's like our weird alien Jedi Tom Waits, and he, like, knows what's up everywhere. He's like the old creepy dude that they bring onto the ship to help them figure out where the hell they're going.
And I kind of designed him when I... Do you remember Rounders with John Malkovich as the...
Of course!
That's why he's wearing like almost like a leisure suit or a jumpsuit, because I just thought it looked like John Malkovich.
KGB, right. Teddy KGB.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Rounders is one of my favorite movies. Pay him, pay that man money.
And that's another thing that's great about this book, is that, like, when Jackson, Colin, and I talk, it's all about just pop references everywhere, not just Star Trek. We talk about Breakfast Club, we talk about, you know, Rounders, we talk about whatever just inspires us to create, and all those things are good stories, doesn't matter if they're sci-fi or not. And I think that's what we're trying to pull with every issue, is something, you know, that we were inspired about from anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole sequence in issue 3 that I've kind of hinted at a couple of times now that like gets pretty weird. I love that cover so much, but that like there's about a 5-page sequence where things get real weird, and I couldn't figure out how to write it. The way that we, Colin and I, like work is we'll separate out our pages, and he'll write, you know, half the book, and I'll write half the book, and then we'll switch that and rewrite each other. It's how we write our screenplays too, so it just felt like a natural way to do it. And I ended up with this kind of abstract sequence that I'm sure at the time when I said, "Oh, I'll do that," I was like, "Oh, I know how to do it. I got this."
You were really confident.
I'm super psyched.
You were super.
And I got into it, and I was like, "This. I have no idea, actually." And I was staying up all night. I tried to watch a couple of things that like did similar stuff, but it was all like, it was all film. I couldn't figure it out. I read some comics, but like they didn't even really try to do what we were trying to do. So I was like, I'm just, I don't know. And then that night was the night that Kanye dropped Life of Pablo. Mm-hmm. And I took a half hour break, and I went outside. I have like a deck that I just like, it was like 1 a.m. It was horrible. I needed to sleep. And I put headphones in and I listened to Ultralight Beam, the first track on that thing. And which I'm unabashedly just like a super fan of, like that specific track, I like blew my mind. And I sat there and I listened to that track maybe like 10 times, and then sat there for another 3 hours and listened to that track 10 more times while I wrote those 5 pages. And by the time they were done, they were exactly what essentially ended up being in the comic book. And they aren't Ultralight Beam in any way, shape, or form, but they would never have come about if I didn't have that song at exactly that moment to like change up my brain in exactly the right way that got me there. Music is really important to this book, which is one of the reasons we're putting out playlists with every issue. Every issue, nice. We drop a Spotify playlist, and it ranges. The first issue has a lot of punk and a lot of like... sort of like pop fun stuff, and that's I think going to be generally true, but I'm going to try to sprinkle in some electronic stuff and some hip-hop stuff and just whatever kind of fits the issue that we're doing. So and I do some show notes for that on Tumblr, which is like a new thing for me, but I'm figuring it out.
Okay, that was going to be my next question then.
Oh yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Well, speaking of, I guess my last question would be, so are you guys doing cons, going to any cons? Where are you going to be soon?
Yes. We are doing some conventions.
We are. So we're doing Rose City. So we'll be at Rose City Comic Con in Portland. We are we're hoping to be at Denver, but we're not sure we're going to be there yet. We're still working on that. We're definitely going to be at New York. We'll be at San Diego. So we'll be at both of those. I never miss New York. I love that show. We will be at...
We're going to do our damnedest to be at Fan Expo.
Yes, we're going to do our very damnedest.
I'll have a couch for you if you need to.
We know you do, buddy.
So, yeah, ideally we'll be up in Toronto for that, and probably Baltimore. We'll probably be at Baltimore. We really like Baltimore. We launched some hacktivists there, and that was really fun, so hopefully there. And I don't know where else, but that's the list as it stands right now. We're doing as much of a circuit as we can. So if we're in a town near you... definitely come check us out. If you follow us on Twitter, we'll obviously tell you every time we go anywhere. So that's an easy way to know what we're up to.
Cool. I'm going to a few different ones because we don't live in the same city, obviously.
Exactly. That's true.
But I just got back from Ottawa. I'm going to be at Fan Expo like I am every year. I'm going to be in Montreal Comic Con and Saskatoon. So a lot of Canadian shows, actually. But headed to Paris Comic Con in October. So that should be fun as well. So maybe we can sprinkle a couple more, but yeah, we're going to try to bring Joyride over to Europe.
Nice. Just with Joyride.
Oui.
I don't know. I don't speak French.
High school is a long time ago.
Yeah.
Spanish.
All right. Dirt, do you have any questions? Because I wanted to touch on something that we were talking about off the air before we started broadcasting, because I know you guys get asked this all the time, harkening back to Hacktivist. I did see, I don't know if it was, I think it was for the second volume, there was a signing at the Downtown Midtown Comics location, and I believe Alyssa Milano was there, and I was kicking myself for not being able to get there, couldn't get out of work. It was some sort of insanity.
It was at the Comic Bug in Torrance. I think it was the last time we signed with Alyssa.
Right, but I think there was an appearance at the Downtown Midtown Comics in New York, and that was the one I was trying.
She did one.
Yeah. You weren't there.
Yeah, we weren't there. That was just Alyssa.
All but right. Still, sorry, mister.
She is pretty great, though. She is
so good with fans. Like, she is so good with everyone who comes by. That's the thing. Like, you know, we've worked, you know, as we previously mentioned, we're Hollywood guys, right? We do some stuff. And we work with celebrities on stuff. And very rarely do they have the poise and the kindness and the intelligence of Alyssa. Like, you come to meet her, she will shake your hand, she will give you a hug, she remembers people's names. Like, I forget Jackson. I forget normal people's names, like, in my life. And Alyssa remembers, you know, like, fan after fan after fan. She's so freaking awesome. And it's like, if there's one lesson we can take away from her in terms of just how to outreach, it's like, go forward with this kind heart and just embrace everybody. Like, it's so fucking cool.
She really genuinely cares. Not just about like her particular outreach, but her fans and their minds and how she can affect them. To the degree that when we set off to do Hacktivist and we said, you know, we really want to do a story that means something to us, you know, her response, which very well could have been, because she was the voice of the book at that time, sure. No, do what I say. That wasn't what happened. We came in and we said, you know, Hacktivist was originally about one guy. We said, we want to make it about two guys. We want to make this a story about us because that's how we can make this personal to us. And she said, go for it. This was originally a story that mostly took place in the U.S. And we said, we want to talk about what's going on in Tunisia because the Arab Spring is fascinating. Sure. And how we as Westerners are interacting with that is fascinating. So we want to fucking talk about that. And she talked to us for a half an hour about the Arab Spring and then was like, go. Like, Alyssa's not a figurehead on this book, and she's like, a lot of people, I think, approach celebrity books with a lot of caution for a good reason. Hacktivist doesn't have that deal. Like, that's just not how it is. Like, we would not have, let me put it this way, and this sounds super, like, stuck up, especially because it basically started our comics career, and a lot of great stuff has come from Hacktivist, but, like, we wouldn't have done it if it were that, right? Like, sure. We didn't need to do comics. We wanted to do comics, and Hacktivist was a great door, but unless it was the right book, we wouldn't have done it. So when we sat down with her, she was interviewing us, but to some degree, we were also interviewing her, and we came away from that both, like, super starstruck, but also, like, really just sort of person-struck. Like, damn, like, you want to do the best version of this thing, and you're really willing to, like, get into the nitty-gritty about it. And the same thing was true of the sequel. You know, the early outlines of the sequel don't look like what Hacktivist 2 became because we sat there with Alyssa and really broke it down.
Wow. Is there a chance for a third volume?
I hope so. Cool. We all want to do it. It's just a matter of time. Like, honestly, all of our efforts are in Joyride right now as a creative team. Sure. And when it's the three of us working, it's got to be the three of us working, you know? So ideally, yes. And I know there's intention on all sides that we can do it. But it really is a matter of time. And frankly, I think Hacktivist 2 left it in a nice place where, like, we could leave it for a while.
Sure.
You know, we can come back to it when we're ready, but Hack 2 has a really nice emotional closure for these two guys, and when we come back to finish up the story, that'll be a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
Cool. So Jackson earlier mentioned everyone's Twitter to find out where the boys will be on the convention tour, but let everyone know where they can follow you on Twitter.
Cool. I am. Nope. Go ahead.
I'm C.P. Kelly. Cat Peter Kelly.
And I am Jackson Lansing, just my name, but Z, no S in the Lansing.
And me, I'm just my name as well, Marcus Toe, T-O.
And you can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Tumblr, you can follow Joyride as a project specifically on Facebook and Tumblr. We put up updates there as well as reblogging from our own like personal stuff. We're really interested in building out that fan community. We've heard a lot of people love the book. We've heard a lot of people been buying the book. Obviously, it went to second printing, so somebody bought the book. When you guys are out there, you know, come talk to us. Engage with us. Interact with us. That's what we're here for, and that's what those forums are there for. So if you like us on Facebook, in fact, you'll see right now we have people coming to this stream from the Facebook. Nice. So that's great. Just like come find us and get involved. Like, this is a fan built project, and will go as long as fans allow it to go. So hopefully people.
Because there's one thing that you should know is that we all love to talk.
Especially when it's about comics.
Exactly.
All right, so yes, make sure next week, May 25th, Joyride number 2 is in stores. Make sure to go to your local comic book distributor, or if you do the online digital comics, purchase that way. However you want to read your comics, make sure check out Joyride number 2 from Boom Studios. May 25th, people.
Right on. Coming this Wednesday.
Thanks, guys.
Coming this Wednesday.
So, yeah, thanks for coming on and talking with us, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. Great.
Totally pleasure.
So we're actually going to keep recording because we usually just talk about comic book reviews, but we all...
Dope.
Of course, y'all can leave now. I'm sure you don't want to talk comics anymore.
We gotta go write some comics.
I was drawing while we were talking, so I mean, I was
that's the multitasker.
Now I know we got pages coming. All right, I'll see you later, guys.
All right, have a good night.
Thank you very much. We'll
be in touch. Bye, guys.
Yeah,
definitely. Bye. Take
care. All right. Now that they're gone.
That was fun.
That was great.
Yeah, let me...
These big, I was about to say these really big full hangouts are getting to be pretty fun. You know, this harkens back to our Treasury edition for Civil War. We didn't even ask them, hey, what do you guys think of Civil War, right?
Yeah, I know.
We need to have like a group of questions to ask every critic, like before they leave, what's your favorite comic book superhero? What's your favorite comic reading as a kid?
I know, right? Oh, you know, and they brought up Cowboy Bebop earlier, and I totally forgot to show them what I had on.
Oh no! Oh man,
Cowboy Bebop fan.
That is funny. Yeah. All right, so
do you happen to have the ads open?
I do. I got a Skull Candy ad, so I will go right into it. So let me tell you about Skull Candy. Skull Candy makes the best headphones, earbuds, and gaming headsets, all with lifetime warranties. Skull Candy produces many types of audio accessories, including headphones, sports earbuds, Xbox gaming headsets, PlayStation gaming headsets, DJ headphones, iPod headphones, and MP3 headphones. And now, for the listeners of the Click Nation's Comic Book Chronicles, Skull Candy offers free, standard shipping on your order. To help keep our podcast free, order from Skull Candy by going to cspn.us, that's cspn.us, then clicking on the Keep Our Podcast Free link. Click on the Skull Candy banner, and then shop for high-quality audio accessories with free, standard shipping. Skull Candy Audio through cspn.us. Do it today.
All right. Let me reload my page here. So since we're running a little late, I guess if each of us can pick maybe like two or three comics that we read this week to talk about. How's that sound?
Well, I think there's one giant book of this week that we have to
at least touch on, right?
Yeah, right. We have to get to that Civil War II number zero that came out this week.
I actually bought a physical copy of that just because I'm a Corpil art fan. I actually liked it. It was kind of surprising.
It was good. I thought it was actually pretty a pretty good start for a Bendis scripted event.
Yeah, I mean, for a zero, it's more about setup than any actually anything actually happening in it. But I was surprised. I thought all the stuff from Free Comic Book Day was going to be from the zero, but I guess it's from the one, which is weird that they give you a glimpse of the future and then you take a step back with the zero that came out, but. I'm definitely intrigued to see where it's going because I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out, especially when you see artwork from, down the line with the two teams and the sides that they're on. The people who are on teams aren't exactly the people that you'd think would be necessarily together on those teams, so I'm interested to see how this plays out.
It's funny that you talk about, the Free Comic Book Day being from the future. It kind of mirrors Ulysses' powers, how he can see the future.
Good synergy. Good pickup.
I wonder the setup with War Machine, if they're trying to sort of level him up to have the impact of his injury or death or whatever happens in the Free Comic Book Day issue to have more weight to it.
I guess.
I wonder if it's just more of they want him to be more on equal footing with Tony. So, I mean, Tony, that he's a former director of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, he definitely has some pull in high-ranking spaces. So here's their chance to push Rhodey up to that same level and get them going head-to-head.
And as you can see from the cover here, let me put my mouse starts at and right, that I can start moving across the screen there. Anyway, but on the cover that Dirt has up, you have Iron Man and War Machine and She-Hulk and Captain Marvel sort of split screen showing the different, the sides and whatnot. Whose cover is that from, I wonder? Who did the art for that?
This is a Ribbick variant.
Okay. Oh, is that Ribbick? Yeah, he's off.
But yeah, nice. I was surprised. I was surprised I liked it as much as I did. And
you thought you were going to hate it?
Well, the whole Civil War, it's been built up so much that I'm kind of lukewarm to it.
Yeah, I can see that.
The concept
of it. Yeah, the concept of it. And especially because it feels like we've been talking about it for 6 months now. It's probably been like 4 months, but still. Mm. But I probably actually won't be purchasing each issue of the Civil War. Actually, you know what? I'll take it back because it does have Dave Marquez art on it. So as long as it's got good art and the story isn't horrible, it's something I'll check out. But we shall see. I'll have to read the review copies first to see if it's something.
Might be sold out by the time you get to your store.
Oh, there's plenty of issues of this, copies of this at my comic shop.
I was about to say, I seriously doubt this one's going to just going to do sell out.
Number one might.
Well, maybe.
Might.
I'm just saying. I'm thinking they might have copies of plain copies.
I have a feeling that I know we definitely at our store ordered a lot of extra copies because we also know it's one of those things where even if it doesn't sell out now, there's going to be someone who comes in when the final issue comes out, going, "Oh, hey, do you have that first issue? I need to get started on that." You know, you always have those people who trickle in towards the end. So,
right.
I'm sure a lot of stores ordered heavy on this one.
Yeah.
All right. I guess there was another big launch over on the DC side of things from their Hanna-Barbera line of comics that they've been promoting recently with Future Quest number one.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting way they did it, actually. So far they've woven in, well, I guess a plausible enough story for what they're trying to go for, or at least for what they're doing. So, I'm actually intrigued about seeing more of it. Like, the art is good, the stories are kind of plausible, which I'll get into in a second. Well, not plausible, because basically it kind of sounds like something we've seen before, but I'd probably be reductive about it. So, basically, we have Johnny Quest, Johnny Quest, Haji, Race, going out, scouting, looking for these, let's just say, incursions type deals going on.
Really?
Kind of.
Yeah, they call them vortexes.
They call them vortexes, but nevertheless, they're incursion-like. Actually, let me go from the beginning, because in the beginning, we actually see a force out in space trying to defeat this one big blob of an enemy or whatnot. They have the power bands that Space Ghost has, which pretty much sets up possibly that Space Ghost was a lantern.
No kidding.
But we don't see Space Ghost as we see him, like, as we know him now, because the person that they kind of set up at the end of that part seemed like it is him, like full-faced him, but not...
Okay, that's something I didn't catch before. So the guy at the beginning...
That's probably Space Ghost, yeah.
Got it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and then something what happens with that, then that's when we cut to Johnny Quest on the here and now, because that happened like years ago, and then we cut to Johnny Quest, and then I'm looking for these vortexes out in the swamp where Benton has set up a lab out in, I guess, Florida somewhere near presumably the nexus of all realities, with the way it's setting out, because it basically says, like, yeah, this is where a lot of stuff, it's far enough out from land, but this is where a lot of stuff has been happening. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for that. Dr. Quest has a meeting with Birdman, and I don't know who the lady
is. Birdman!
Yeah, but it's Birdman.
Attorney at law?
That's the thing. I can't.
Nope, not attorney at law.
it's hard for me to take the Cartoon Network series out of my head when I see these characters now. You know, Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, Space Ghost, the talk show host.
Right.
Well, so, yeah, but if you're of a certain vintage, you can kind of go past that, you know, because you were kind of there. Which actually, reading this thing has kind of made me want to go back and actually watch some of that stuff. Like, I have Johnny Quest here, and I don't know if I have Space Ghost series and whatnot. But anyway, so like I said, Dr. Quest is meeting with Birdman in his agent, because apparently he's the agent of Internation, I think that's what they call it, but it's kind of a S.H.I.E.L.D.-like thing, who is even headed up by a one-eyed person named, I guess, Falcon 7, who...
Really?
I think that comes from his, from his actual cartoon.
History.
Yeah, because he's never seen him, because he's asking the other agent that's with him, like, what's he look like? And there's like, the other's like, I just know about just as much as you do, you know. But I did some reading on, you know, some background reading on Birdman, because I've seen it, but I don't know too much about it. But yeah, they basically said, this is, you know, this is that, and this is that, and this is that. So they're meeting with Dr. Quest, and they're basically trying to get their ideas together. Like, basically, Benton Quest is this big wig. He's kind of like Reed Richards, pre-powers. He's like, so just like in his world, he's like, he's the preeminent doctor of this and that other. So basically, it was like, well, if he's saying there's a problem, we need to look into it. And that's where these agents come in and meeting with him. And where it comes in as, like, has to do with Dr. Zen is actually looking for artifacts that are dropping, that are being left by these vortexes that are being left. So he's racing to get it for his group called Fear. Dr. Quest is trying to get him to keep it out of his hands, but it seemed like Dr. Zen's kind of one step ahead of him, which leads to Dr. Zen sending his little spider, if you've seen Johnny Quest, the little spider robots after him to go get these artifacts, because there are some more vortexes coming about. So that happens. As Johnny Quest does, he gets caught up with it. Race gets shot down. things happen. It is actually a pretty good thing. You see flashes of pretty much a bunch of other people that you see on this cover that Dirt's got up or you know, that's being shown. Mm-hmm. Like, you see a Herculoid kind of show up that, you know, may or may not be heard or whatever, but, and you see flashes of other people. And then there's, at the end of it, you see an appearance by somebody from the beginning of the book.
And looks like he's going to do bodily harm to some kids. So.
To Johnny Quest and Hajian and whoever this other kid is.
Pick on someone his own size.
Yeah. So it was actually, like, I was pretty interested in it. Yeah, really. I was like, okay, I don't know how they were going to pull this together, but so far, it looks
I'll make some time to read this, then.
It sounds like you guys really sold it to me. Yeah.
Great.
Something I know Dirt more than likely read was the second to last part of The Final Days of Superman in Superman Wonder Woman number 29.
I did, as a matter of fact. I just, again, I love the way that they're doing this as a weekly episodic story. It just continues from beat to beat to beat, from issue to issue to issue. We're now part 7 of this ongoing epic story. And the fact that it comes out so quickly, you know, unlike like Justice League, I love the story that's in Justice League, but it takes like 5.5 months in between each issue or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas this is coming out so quickly that it just feels like there's so much more energy behind it. And the fact that they've woven all these different storylines together, they brought Supergirl back in. They've got what's going on in the Lois and Clark book tying into this. Again, all the stuff that's caught up to Superman, bringing in the final days of him dying and having this other new random Superman guy appear, and you still don't know exactly what his deal is. But I can see that character that they have of him, you know, more than likely at the end of this, he'll be somehow stripped of his powers and thrown into a cell and forgotten about, but he's definitely a character that they can bring back, you know, at some point down the line. I think whenever you have an evil version of somebody as a villain, that's a good character to play off of as the story goes. So I'm really enjoying the story. It's just a, you know, fast-paced, action-packed, all these plot threads coming together. So it's one of those things I really enjoy.
I like that his origin seems to, the villain, his origin seems to be he gets his powers from the solar flare that Superman lets let loose. Kind of
different. Yeah, so somehow it's tied into it. It's, you know, the same way that the cyborg Superman from that whole storyline, the way he got his powers, and when they had the Kryptonian Superman after the death of Superman, how that was tied into it. It's like everything is tied together and connected somehow, and it's done well enough, you know, that it doesn't feel like it's cheap, you know, like retcon, like, oh, you know, something happened between these two panels, and so now it leads into this big story that's so stupid. I like the way that this, it feels like it's building, you know, as opposed to just random stuff popping out of nowhere.
Cool. And I gotta give props to Jorge Jimenez's art. When I saw his name on the credits on the front cover, I made sure to have it be one of the first books I read this week.
Cool.
I'm a big fan. And that's all the books I read this week.
Oh, wow. I mean, we'll just cover a couple of things real quickly then.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Power Man and Iron Fist number 4. Who else read that?
Yeah, I did.
So we have the conclusion to the opening story arc, basically the reunion of Luke Cage and Danny Rand. And surprisingly, you know, what we find here is that the main antagonist of the first arc really doesn't realize what she's getting into, and one of Power Man and Iron Fist's original or old school villains kind of comes out very sympathetic, because she doesn't, you know, she's not trying to reinvent herself as a mainstream evildoer. She realizes that the antagonist, who used to be an employee of Power Man and Iron Fist when they were heroes for hire, you know, she realizes that you know, her jailbird friend is kind of in over her head. And it was a very interesting kind of development for these characters. We also have a lot of great character interaction with some of the supporting cast. Tombstone has a couple of great scenes. His lackeys have a couple of great scenes, as they've had over the first 4 issues. And it was just a nice wrap to the first arc. It's very fun to read. Obviously, David Walker and Sanford Green are having a great time with this. So it's if you haven't jumped on yet, I think this is a good place to not start, but now that you have the finale to the first arc, to kind of read them all as one and see what you think.
One of the books I read this week, Martian Manhunter 12, this was the ending of this series. And I have loved this series since issue one for all the oddball, out of left field stuff that throws in here. This issue has a reveal at the end that on the one hand, I love it, but on the other hand, you can tell it's kind of rushed. The story that they told here feels like it easily could have been, a couple dozen issues instead of just the 12 that they had to work with Rebirth coming. But the reveal, I don't want to give it away, but it was one of those things that it just like blows your mind. It makes sense to the story that they've been building, but it's something that you don't see coming.
He's moving to the CW? What?
No. He's going to CBS pay on demand video.
Yeah.
But no, it's hard to describe, and again without spoiling it, because it is a huge reveal. I mean, it is a really big reveal for the character. It's a massive tonal shift for Martian Manhunter, but at the same time, like, you never see it coming, but as soon as it's there, it makes sense. And I just wish they had more time to play with it and to play it out, because it is just a great story. It is a great way of rebuilding Martian Manhunter into a very interesting character. They've made him even more interesting in just this last issue. So I don't know what their plans are for him in Rebirth. And I think in the promotional material, they've only shown him once, and he looked like normal Martian Manhunter, not like this guy on the cover. So I'm not sure how much of this is going to carry over into Rebirth, but this story on its own was just fantastic. I can't recommend enough just grabbing these 12 issues or getting the trade or, whatever. This is definitely a story that's worth reading for anybody out there reading superhero books.
It was definitely one of my highlights of the DCU crop of books that came out.
Very good.
Cool.
Nice.
What else we got?
Spider-Woman number 7.
While not much happens in this book, it's still a great read.
Exactly. Yeah, all that pretty much happens is Jessica's back home. She goes back home, comes to find out that her Earth 65 counterpart is already there at her house and making himself at home, getting to know Roger and the kid, and he even does some stuff around the house. Jess is quite naturally pissed at this, so they have a nice little civil conversation with Roger, get him out of the room, and they present the scrap for a little bit until the baby starts crying, and then they call a truce, and then they talk. And meanwhile, Gwen is at, I guess she's at the planet, or the planet, the Bugle, or wherever she is. excuse me.
It's like the History Channel or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, well, she's at Cindy's job, who I think she worked for J. Jonah, and I can't remember in what capacity. But anyway, she's there, and she went to look for some information that was gotten in one of the recent issues of the series, of the miniseries. She goes through that and finds out basically Jesse's, which is Jessica's counterpart, finds out his backstory and finds out that he's been duped this whole time. Also, and goes to find Jessica at her apartment. Then they have words and fight, and apparently Gwen still doesn't have her powers in this one, which is kind of confusing because we knew something would happen to him. Yeah, spoiler, but she lost him a couple of issues back during a fight with Earth 65 Cindy.
Right. If you recall, I believe it was during the Silk issue where we weren't quite sure what the status of her powers were. They were kind of scrambled more so than negated or removed. But in this one, it definitely seemed like her powers had been removed. But there are some things happening in story, right? Things happening in story where we may find that she could be restored in the near future.
Right.
So we'll see where that goes. Like I said, it seemed like not a lot happened, but we did move the story along, and we are now hurtling towards the end of the Spider-Women crossover into Spider-Women Omega.
Right.
So I'll be glad that story is finally over. I've been now chomping at the bit to kind of see where it ends, because I remember originally saying, oh, it's only a 2-month crossover between three titles with two bookend issues. It's not going to be so bad, but it feels like the last maybe two chapters have kind of dragged, so I kind of want to see it end.
Right, and more importantly, to see how it goes for them, like see how they end up.
Exactly.
After this is all over, where they are in the story and where they're going to go from there, I guess.
Exactly.
One quick advantage of this series is it's done the same thing that the Last Days of Superman has done, is issue each week, I believe.
Yes.
So. Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. It actually made me kind of slightly interested in reading Silk.
I'm still kind of like, but it makes it fun to keep up with the character. You know, it makes it easier to keep up with the character because it's a crossover.
Right. Well, I'm saying that because I didn't, like, I knew where she came from and this, but I never really actually read her book before, prior to this.
Gotcha. All right. Just very quickly, Silver Surfer number 4 was a nice touching issue. You have anything else to say?
Yeah.
Spider-Man. Oh, good.
No, I was about to say, it's actually, I mean, taken up after last issue. He fought, you know, Shalabal and the Zenlavians who were trying to take over the Earth. He fought them back and presumably died in the process, except for a nice little out that was given to themselves.
Yeah, it was a nice little callback to some stuff that had happened a few issues ago. Yeah. And it was nice to see Slott kind of wrap that up, you know, kind of tie that back in. And, you know, kind of, you know, reach a new status quo for the Surfer that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, indeed. You just see, hey, the Avengers come and help him out since he's recuperating and kind of, you know, the Surfer kind of gets a nice little hurrah.
Sure, I think Dan Slott gave the All Reds a couple of really choice scenes to be able to draw a lot of the current Marvel heroes and give them a good reason to come to the Surfer's aid.
Oh, and especially Alicia Masters.
That was a great scene.
Yeah.
Great scene. Nice to see Alicia come through like that.
Yeah, totally. She was pretty badass.
All right. I don't want to dwell too much more on the books. Spider-Man number 4, we had, you know, a couple of, you know, interactions between Miles, Gonki, and the new student who happens to be a former X-Man, Goldballs. And it was a lot of interesting character interplay there. It seems like Goldballs is going to be a pretty major supporting character in this book for a little while.
I felt like this issue was a little off. Like, it just didn't seem to have the same level of fun and interest as the last few issues have had. There were a couple spots where the artwork was a little awkward, trying to do the facial expressions. I just didn't think worked quite as well, and dialogue was a little clunky in spots. I mean, by no means was it bad,
right,
or anything like that, but it just felt like it didn't quite live up to as all the fun and goodness we've had leading up to this one.
I definitely feel where you're coming from on that, because I felt like we were lingering for a long, long time on the lunchroom conversation.
Yeah.
And it just felt like it was taking forever.
And it was one of those where I could understand he was trying to do this fun, punchy style dialogue, you know, that the new comedy, if you watch a lot of TV comedies, the way they spit the dialogue back and forth, he was trying to do.
Sure.
But when you're doing that on a printed page and it's, you know, so you can only put so many words per box, you end up with all these boxes full of words and these faces just kind of in the background. And after a while, you're just like, okay, can something please happen somewhere?
Yeah, to break this up, yeah.
Right.
No, I definitely understand.
I did like Spidey, though, the more all-ages version of Spider-Man retelling his first team-up here with Iron Man. And you can see Iron Man in that old-school armor.
Classic.
Okay.
On the cover. This was actually a lot of fun. For everybody who's a fan of the awesome facial hair bros, you're getting that type of vibe continuing to play out in this story as well. So this was a lot of fun.
All right.
He even has the old school sort of logo in the corner.
Yeah, you've got that little box in the corner with the faces. And the digital edition has that old school Comics Code Authority stamp around it. So
nice.
They played a lot with this cover. It's pretty good.
Cool. Did anyone read Uncanny Avengers number 9?
I started it.
I meant to, but no.
Read it. It was actually surprisingly good, because I have been down on this book for a while, but this book kind of, you know, this issue kind of picks up a lot of it just picks up the action a little bit. It picks up the tone a little bit. I find this book is kind of reinvigorated just in this one issue. There is a reappearance of a certain Avenger. I don't want to spoil it, but because you guys haven't read it yet.
I mean, it's already out there. But
yeah. Right, but at the same time, I don't want to spoil it right out, you know, just throw it out there. So ultimately, I would recommend reading this, because it is kind of a refreshing issue in this run. Uncanny Avengers has kind of been, you know, hit and miss for me because of a lot of the Inhuman stuff that they had been pursuing during the earlier issues of this newly relaunched volume. But I think this being the start of a new story is a nice jumping on point. There's a lot of great dialogue in this. Jerry Duggan has a couple of nice lines inserted for multiple characters in this. You know, a lot of characters have a chance to shine during this issue. So I can't recommend this book enough as a nice jumping on point.
I picked it up for two reasons. One, because of the story, new story arc, and the Avenger that makes their re-debut. And number two, for Pepe Larraz's art,
yes,
who was the previous artist on the Star Wars Kanan book. I'm a fan of his. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does have good art, so that's another plus for the issue.
Well, from your beginning of an arc to Sinestro's end of his run, this is ending because of Rebirth. But this is actually really good. The storyline leading up to this is that Sinestro was weakened and could no longer lead the Sinestro Corps, so he turned it over to his daughter. And his daughter is actually a former Green Lantern. So her take on everything is obviously different from her father's. But it turns out that as everything works out in the storyline, the two of them are really working towards the same goal. And the goal is to save the people of their home planet. Their home planet keeps coming under attack, and they had to evacuate their planet and find a new home. And it's just interesting the way that Colin Bunn has been able to play on this idea that Sinestro is not necessarily evil. He's just more self-focused and focused on his people more than anyone else. He puts them above everyone else. So he'll threaten and endanger all these other people and planets and races, but he's doing it for the honor and for the safety and security of his people. So, you know, you always think of him as being this, you know, grand villain, of course, the big baddie fighting Green Lantern at every turn, but the story has really played up the fact that he actually does care for his people, and that everything he does has been in this effort to guide them and keep them safe. And it's just, it's been really interesting the way they've played off that these last few issues. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sad now that it's ending for Rebirth.
Does Poe Dameron show up?
He might be in the background of one of the scenes because you can't see all the people in the crowd, but he very well could have been.
Nice.
All right. Are we ready to clicks of the week?
Yeah, I am.
I guess so.
Wait, Tim, you didn't read Harley Quinn?
Not yet. It's on my list.
Had the follow-up to Red Tool.
Yeah, the reason I'm reading it, because I read the previous issue of Red Tool, so I want to see how they're going to resolve it, or if the story continues on for a couple more issues.
And I was never going to read this book, because of you. I had to read the last one, and so I'm going to have to read this one.
So you liked it.
Yeah, Red Tool is actually a really good character.
This book has generally been good. Granted, I'm slightly lapsed on it, but generally this book has been all right, but I need to catch up on it to get to this point.
Yeah, I didn't think I'd like it as much as I did.
Yeah, but speaking of Red Things, Dead Things, whatever, did anybody read Deadpool and the Last Days of Magic?
Nope.
Not yet.
Okay.
Have you been reading all the Last Days of Magic stuff?
Yeah. I just pretty much caught it back up on it because I didn't read. Well, it's only been like two issues, but I mean, I read them like just yesterday. So, and I was trying to figure out whether this was in there or not, but it seemed like it might be.
Well, my click of the week is going to be Martian Manhunter. That one's pretty easy for me.
Nice.
Okay. Perfect cap on the story. Like I said, there's a big, huge reveal on it that changes the whole nature of the character. It was really a well-done series. Definitely a book that I will buy the collected edition or editions. I don't know if it's going to be two volumes or whatever, but that's definitely one I'm going to buy and put on the shelf. I love this series a lot.
Nice. Yeah, mine is Civil War II, number zero. It was a very pleasant surprise to read a pretty solid introduction to and pretty solid setup to this big crossover.
I'm going to go with Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, number 29.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a very pretty issue, and I like the sort of how they've inserted Superwoman or Supergirl into it, and I'm just curious to see how this is going to end and lead into Rebirth.
Okay. I think it was actually slightly tough for me, but I think I'm going to go with Future Quest number one.
Wow. We got like a full nice spread of clicks of the week this week.
Yeah, it ended up being a little more compelling. Now, nostalgia aside, it ended up being a little more compelling than I thought it would have been.
Did you buy the regular wrap cover, or did you buy the character?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I bought... what did I put it? I bought the regular cover... Yeah, which is the one. Well, I bought the regular cover, which I think is this one.
Yeah.
And then I bought the Johnny Quest one.
Nice.
Yeah, they had a couple of them. They even had like the one, I guess you could color.
Also. I love the Space Ghost one because it's a Bill Sienkiewicz artwork, and I love his artwork.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm. And it's the Ghost cast, I guess.
And then I think back to Space Ghost. And especially the way the, what is it, cockroach, whatever that thing is in the background.
Zorak.
Yeah. real quick. I just got
something.
He's
a mantis, not a cockroach. But
yeah.
I need someone with crit me.
Real quick, I just got this in the mail because I guess we're moving on to cinematic or leaving, or I don't know what we're doing, but I got this in the mail, the variant cover for Black Panther number 2.
Nice.
It's a green cover, and it's supposed to be a connected cover, so I'm guessing it's in the next couple of issues.
Keep the variants coming.
Yeah, very cool.
So suddenly, and they also sent me, because I got this from not a sponsor, whatever, but I got this from the place I ordered from, and they gave me these
combo,
which, funnily enough, I have the Serenity one, but the Suicide Squad, which I didn't pick up, which was good because now I can read it. Not that I was that interested in, but why not? And this, of course, this one with Avatar on one side and Korra on the other side, which they sent me for some reason.
I still haven't read all of my Free Comic Book Day issues.
Neither have I.
Yeah, and a bunch of them have started showing up on Comixology.
So exactly. Yeah, I was going
to
mention that too.
If there's some you were looking for, now's the time to go digging for them.
Cool.
All right.
By next week, they'll probably be out there, all out there, or most of them.
Let's get that last ad read in.
All right, I got it. So let us do My Comic Shop. Today's podcast is sponsored by My Comic Shop. Go to cspn.us, then click on the Keep Our Podcast free link at the top of the page. From there, click on the My Comic Shop banner and order from a vast selection of new releases, back issues, vintage classics, graphic novels, and more to be delivered right to your door. Why bother schlepping to the local comic book store when you can order your books online? My Comic Shop through cspn.us. Do it today.
And in cinematic news, we have rumors of more Justice League movie villains are starting to surface. So there's Steppenwolf, who appeared in a deleted scene that was released like the day after Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice was in theaters. Supposedly the rumor is, I think, Steppenwolf being the villain in the first part, Justice League Part 1, and then Darkseid showing up in Part 2. Lupita Nyong'o's in talks to star Marvel's Black Panther, and it looks like Michael B. Jordan has already signed on to be in the Black Panther cast.
Rescuing another Human Torch.
I know, right? They've actually said that in the last couple of days, yeah.
And what made that hilarious, it was like the same day that that news was breaking, I think CBR had some quotes from someone that worked on the Fantastic Four movie saying how they wanted to bring everyone back for a sequel. It's like, yeah, I don't think so, buddy. Let's see, Marvel's Inhumans movie is still happening once they figure out where to put it. Bryan Singer says the next X-Men movie could be in space.
In space!
Dwayne Johnson is making a cool movie with Shane Black in 2017.
Yeah, they're talking about doing Doc Savage.
Sure.
Okay.
You know. Yeah. I mean, that's all.
Isn't that a Hanna-Barbera character? Or am I wrong?
No.
No.
Okay. No, he's just a Golden Age newspaper strip guy, radio play guy.
Speaking of Star Trek from our earlier interview with the Joyride creative team, CBS released a teaser trailer and logo for the 2017 series, which is going to be on their on-demand, digital pay-as-you-go service.
Although the funny thing I noticed is that it said it would be coming to CBS and the CBS All Access app.
So yeah, I read wondering, that.
Did it get picked up for the regular network as well?
That would what be I cool read, if it did.
What I read today is the first episode is going to be on, I guess, regular CBS, and then after that, all subsequent.
Kind of like they did with Supergirl, except for Supergirl, stayed on TV.
I gotcha.
Let's see, the Wolverine 2 as Fear the Walking Dead star Elizabeth Rodriguez for a role. She was in Orange and Is the New Black in Fear the Walking Dead. Her role's going to be small, so who cares?
Oh, no!
Batman v Superman Fallout. Warner Brothers shakes up executive roles. John Berg and Jeff Johns will co-run the newly created DC Films in an attempt to course-correct Warner Brothers comic book movies.
God. Is it too little, too late?
I'm going to be on the optimistic side and say this is a good thing.
Yeah, there's been some positivity behind that news because, you know, people trust Geoff Johns, so, hey.
He's done well with the television universe.
Mm-hmm.
Supergirl, speaking of which, joins Flash, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow for a December crossover on CW.
Right. This is hard on the heels of the news that Supergirl is now moving to the CW.
Where she probably needed to be in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to say, probably she belongs.
Probably.
Yep. So just let DC and Warner Brothers comic books just take over the CW as it should be.
It might be getting to be stretched a little bit because now
I can feel that a little bit.
Yeah, because I mean, Arrow and Flash crossovers is one thing, and that's cool. Now they got Legends of Tomorrow they're gonna throw in. Now they're just throwing in another one. It's like, okay, they're almost getting multi-part comic book events. Well, I guess that was the point.
I feel like Arrow, people don't appreciate Arrow anymore because there's all these other shows out now.
Well, yeah, because they've taken the Arrow recipe and made them better with these other shows.
Yeah.
And throwing in special effects too, so.
Yeah.
Arrow hasn't been as entertaining the last, like, two seasons as it had been, so. Yeah. It's in that point where it's been on TV long enough now where it's like, what else can they do? At least that's the way I feel.
Okay, yeah.
Let's see, we had the 2016 solicits from all the publishers this week, or the August 2016 solicits, I should say. And sad news, Darwin Cook, celebrated comic artist and writer, passed away over the weekend.
Yes, very suddenly the news dropped. Well, I mean, suddenly in the sense that the news dropped that he was in palliative care, and then, barely 24 hours had passed, and the news of his passing came down.
Well, that's why I'm saying that, because I don't think of that stuff. I think they just had to tell people. Because, I mean, they've been pretty secretive. His parents have been pretty secretive about it. So, I mean,
his wife.
Family. Yeah. So I think it's been going on for a while. They just get to the point where it's like, okay, we might as well tell people.
Sure.
So, of course, we send our condolences to his family and friends. Let's see, Marvel Star Wars Darth Vader comic will end with issue 25. I like how they've thrown Star Wars : Darth Vader in front of it now.
I know, right?
Darth Vader. But they've hit an end point, so.
Yeah, like I was talking online about this. I hate to see it go, but at the same time, this book has been selling pretty well, and it's seemingly doing all right. Well, it's been good, so.
Yeah, and they've said that this is the end. This is the end of the story that Gillen was going to do, so he was going to be leaving the book anyway. So this opens it up where they can wait 6 months and then come back with a new Darth Vader number one from a new creative team and start the frenzy all over again, because every time you have a new number one, everything goes crazy.
Yeah.
My biggest takeaway was that Kieran Gillen isn't done with Marvel just yet, because he said
he's got another project.
I figured he'd be gone, just because that's what they do after a while. Go and work on their Image books 24/7.
Hey, you got to get the next chapter of Young Avengers out.
Or not.
Yes.
Something called Some Sums Invades Marvel Universe.
I liken it to this year's Madballs.
Did I pronounce it right?
I think so.
Oh, who cares?
Yeah, who knows? Who cares?
But. Okay. DC's new Superman introduces new Batman, new Wonder Woman, and solicits. The more I see the art and sort of the solicits for this series, the more I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully it doesn't disappoint, because Yang's Superman run was kind of started slow and kind of picked up for me, so hoping he brings in a new Superman. Black Panther is the best-selling comic in April 2016.
Yes, let's keep it up.
Valiant live streamed their Valiant Summit this week and announced new projects and titles, Generation Zero, Harbingers, Renegade, Britannia, and more.
Did you watch it?
No, I need to actually watch it. Did you?
No, because I saw you tweet about it, and that's what I picked this up.
I was doing the I was traveling that day, so I'll just have to catch it on the replay. Something you let us know about earlier in the week, the rise of superheroes and their impact on pop culture. It's a free online course offered by the Smithsonian and led by Stan Lee, Michael Uslan, David Uslan, and Dr. Christopher Ribicard.
Yeah, just started on the 17th. I forgot to sign up for it. I'm actually kind of interested in seeing what it's about. So.
Dynamite Day 2016 unveils new Battlestar Galactica Eva Ernie books. And, of course, Battlestar Galactica, I think, is from Cullen Bunn, who writes everything. IDW's X-Files Origins introduces Teen Scully and Mulder.
Okay.
Oy, oy, oy.
John Lewis's graphic novel to be taught in New York City public schools.
That's cool.
The Legend of Wonder Woman will continue from Renee Del Liz. She announced that her and DC are working on, I guess, part two of the series. And DC Comics has a new logo, which I had to get used to. Yeah, I like the logo. It's just like seeing it. It's like jarring when I see it.
Yeah, it's a throwback to their old 70s logo. And I mean, I'm fine with it. I mean, that's the one I remember actually from being a little kid. And then Before the Bullet.
Before the Bullet, yeah.
Yeah.
Two broke girls star Beth Bears makes Comics debut with Apocalyptic Dents. And that's about it. So right. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to tonight's episode of Comic Book Chronicles. Send a special shout out to Marcus Toe, Colin Kelly, and Jackson Lansing again for joining us, the creators behind Joyride. Make sure again to go purchase that next Wednesday, May 25th. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at TimDOGG98 and at CBCron. Agent 70 is at Agent_70. And on Instagram at Agent_70.
Yep.
Roddy Cat is at Roddy Cat and at News Nerds Need.
Since my Lord Thurs don't seem to want to work.
Ah, nice. Good job. Good job.
I was about to test mine again, see, but probably won't work. And Dirt is at PCN_Dirt. And go to his website, popculturenetwork.com.
I see mine actually appears on the screen. You can see where it is right there.
As does mine.
What browser are you using, Dirt?
I'm actually using Internet Explorer in Windows 10. It's hidden in Windows 10. If you go digging, Internet Explorer is still there, and that's what I have to use to get Hangouts to work correctly. Which is funny. It's a Google product, and it doesn't work right in Chrome.
Exactly.
It works right in old school Internet Explorer.
Right.
Not the Edge version. It is actual.
No, not Edge. Right. Yeah. If you go to the little search box, you do a search for Internet Explorer. It's still there, hidden in
Windows. Yeah, I've seen it. But
listen, I'm about to do that now.
I'm on a Mac, and I'm using Firefox, and that's how I get it to work.
Weird.
Yep.
There it is, Internet Explorer. Okay. Might try that next week.
Yeah, just go to hangouts.google.com.
All right, so we will be back next week with another assigned episode. We are the Comic Book Chronicles, and we are signing off.
Hey!